Well, hello everyone, and welcome to another interview. I am here with longtime friend of the channel, Walrus, who presents a podcast called The Longhouse. Is that still going, Walrus?
We're still doing The Longhouse, yeah. Thank you for having me on, by the way. We're still going strong. The format has changed a little bit over the years, as both me and my co-host, Loving Path, are dads now. We don't have time to sit for hours on end. to discuss minutia, but we still try to show up every week and have a good time, honestly.
Excellent. I'll just remind people before we get going, pick up courses at the Academic Agency, buy it now, trivia and the bestseller there, Foundations Shakespeare, many other great courses available. But you, Walrus, wanted to talk about Americans versus René Guénon.
Yes.
For many people watching this, obviously I know who René Guénon is. They won't know who Guénon is at all. Obviously they know what Americans are, but who is René Guénon?
So René Guénon, as you said, might be a bit of a more obscure character in the modern right-wing canon compared to someone who he influenced greatly, Julius Evola. But Guénon was a French philosopher and thinker who sort of bears a lot of the burden of bringing the capital T tradition, the fall of modernity, as it were, to the forefront. And as I said, was a confidant to a certain degree and a huge inspiration to someone like Julius Evola. And I find for myself, reading specifically The Reign of Quantity and The Signs of Our Times, to have, while Guénon is quite a difficult thinker to wield, I suppose, in contrast to Evola, who's a bit more fiery and presents a clear vision of maybe what was lost in his eyes, Guénon has what I think is a better frame, a better lens to apply to reality. Maybe that's my experience. I find him more useful, albeit a bit more dry than someone like Evola. So that's sort of the keynote.
It's probably worth mentioning. Although Evola looked up a lot to Guénon, they had a few key little disagreements.
Yes.
Mainly on, I guess, choice of path, you might say.
Yeah.
Evola always preferred the path of the hero, the man of action, and so on.
Yes.
And more specifically, the idea of a kind of warrior ruling class, whereas he maintained that was, you know, the kind of proper tradition, the proper European way, whereas Guénon was more, one might say, the path of contemplation, or the path of devotion, whichever way you want to put it, and he favoured a more priestly kind of Brahmin ruling class. I would say if they disagreed anywhere, it was just on the priorities that they gave those various things. And I mean, as you can imagine, that makes Evola a little bit sexier for a lot of people because, you know, action and heroism is cool.
it is very cool. And it's very fun to hope for the Caesar to come. But I think if it's anything that Guénon would teach you is that that's not going to happen. But you might get something else, which we might talk about in one of the other topics I have. I think by the end of the three topics I have planned, the idea is that, you know, the total context paints a picture that leans a bit more towards Guénon than Evola. It's not going to be as fire and brimstone as maybe some people hope.
Yeah. The only other additional bit of context before I let you kind of unfold exactly what he's saying and where Americans come in as well is his famous book was actually not The Reign of Quantity and the Sign of the Times, which I also think is a very good book, by the way. But I think his famous one is called Crisis of the Modern World. That was the direct inspiration for Evola's Revolt Against the Modern World.
Yes.
It's kind of, and there's a lot, I mean, you can kind of see that in a way Evola ends up being like York Notes to Guinan in a strange way. If you actually read Crisis of the Modern World, there's a lot of stuff that's just kind of...
Evola himself published a book that's sort of like that he intended to be sort of the bridge between their thoughts with like correspondences between them and his commentary on Guinan essentially. Mm-hmm.
All right. So why don't we get into what is it that Guinan is saying, and why is it relevant for us today, and why is it René Guinan versus Americans as well?
Well, I mean, maybe I'm doing a bit of editorializing because Guinan, you know, predates a lot of the woes of modernity in a sense, but he called the shot. So using his frame or using his language against the state or the dynamism of America is actually, I think, a very apt critique. And I also want to sort of contrast that maybe a bit with the remnants of Europe. But I think first, especially with the Reign of Quantity, Guinan gets into a lot of sort of scholastic philosophy, and the first half is almost just redefining words. So for the audience sake, I think I should just do like a quick metaphysical foundation, I guess, because the key polarity that Guinan sort of posits is the idea of quality versus, I guess, quantity, on polar opposites, although not necessarily mutually exclusive. These are sort of the metaphysical forces of the universe. So essence or quality is the sort of formal determining principle in Guinan's hierarchy. It's what makes something, it's what defines something. It connects you to sort of your being. It's the spiritual pole. It is the higher sort of Plato's ideal in Guinan's world is quality. Meanwhile, quantity, or what he sometimes calls substance, is sort of the material determinable principles. The more physical world, the lower pole in his metaphysics, and in general, things that can be measured in a sense, Guinan aligns to quantity. But he also says that sort of maybe potentiality is also substance or quantity, but ultimately things that become homogeneous as well. So, you know, if you want to reduce it incredibly, it's, you can say that, you know, quantity, well, things you can number, you can measure, you can see, you can feel. Quantity is everything that has worth, that is unmeasurable. That is a very big reduction, but just for the sake of anyone listening. So what Guinan says is that everything in the world sort of combines both of these to a certain extent. Like there's nothing that is pure quantity, there's nothing that is pure quality. Although maybe if Guinan lived in the modern times, he would have maybe found something that he defined as pure quantity. And this is sort of where he does a bit of a flourish, where he says that, okay, so everything contains quantity and quality, but sort of the total orientation of the thing, of a person, of a civilization, of a ritual, is what matters. And the traditional civilizations, capital T tradition, always, in a very Evolian way, points upward towards the higher power, towards maximizing quality, while a modern society will tend to maximize quantity. And again, if you want to reduce this quite a lot, you could say that you know, if you value bean counting, then you're a creature of quantity. And this is also what makes it quite kind of difficult to wield Gwinnon, because according it's kind of like Spengler. According to Gwinnon, you know, we're all lost. There's no point in any of this. This is the Kali Yuga, the Dark Age. But this framing of quantity versus quality and being able to define things as having intrinsic value, not just by what they are, but how you use something or how you interact with it, is very, very telling and a very good lens to wield when looking at the way, well, let's say America went compared to its start. So what Gwinnon argues is going to happen in modernity when he writes Reign of Quantity is that we're going to have two sort of phases, which is what he calls solidification and then dissolution. And solidification, he says, is probably the realm of the 17th to 19th century, and then dissolution is everything onward. And what he means is that when the world solidifies, is that we only care about, as I said, the things that are measurable. The only thing that's worth something to a modern human, or to a modern in the 19th century sense, is things that are measurable. It is sort of the peak. He's critiquing sort of the peak rationalism, European rationalism here. Probably starting with someone like some of the French philosophers. He also calls that religion will be reduced to moralism, which I think he got pretty correctly. And he talks about what he calls like a great wall that separates the physical corporeal world from everything above it, everything higher. And if I were to add on to that, it's kind of interesting in the sense that the European rationalism that Gwinnon sort of argues is the cause of the problems, the sickness, I guess. It is also for a while the thing that keeps sort of the great wall, as he calls it, from shattering. There's something about the you can have European liberalism if your nation is, you know, 130 IQ Anglos meme, that sort of keeps this actually quite stable for a while. But I think, and this is sort of where the critique of America comes in, is that the dynamism of America really sort of blows past this wall into the dissolution phase quite quickly. So the dissolution essentially means that you break down all of these rational structures that have been built up to serve reason, and you sort of start seeing resurgent spiritualities that have nothing to do with the higher sacred powers. So you'll get either a bunch of minor religions, or you get an inversion of religions where you'll see sort of religious practice, quote unquote, being performed towards, I guess, what Evola would call counter-tradition, religious practices that might not be explicitly religious, that denies capital T tradition. And I know you've done videos on the Boomer Truth regime, and you know, everyone singing Imagine and holding hands, and in a sense, this is a religious practice, and that's nothing new to the people probably in this circle. But it's mm-hmm. interesting to note that, you know, when we get into dissolution, that's when all hell breaks loose, as it were. So, the question then becomes: America as the sort of dynamic nation it was in the start, would it ever have inhabited the solidification phase? If you read someone like Dewey, they would argue that American pragmatism would probably be explicitly anti-metaphysical, that it would explicitly seek to rid itself of, you know, quality, the philosophical in the philosophical sense, and move to sort of pure instrumentality, I guess. Does it work? Would be the only, I guess, and if you want to put a fine point on it, I'd say, can you sell it? Would be the only thing the American would care about when confronted with anything. That's a bit of a harsh reading, in my opinion, because I do believe there were a transitional period and at the end of the 18th, 19th century, and a little bit into the 20th. You have yourself talked about, is it Ford? Who used to sort of embody this almost monarchical role in his industry. I've read accounts of Philip Armour, the meatpacking industrialist, who would almost hold court in his office. If you worked for him, or if you knew someone who worked for him, you could have that person sort of petition him for you to have a meeting with him. And if he found you to be of sufficient character, he could help you out. So if you needed money to get back home or something, if you knew someone who worked for Armour, he would sort of, again, hold court, and you could petition him for money, almost like a feudal lord. In quite late in our history, actually. So I think to say that America sort of started off on the wrong foot is a bit of a sort of disingenuous reading. I don't want to just criticize America because I'm European. I want to be nice. But certainly the speed and dynamism in which Americans do operate and do sort of get to that point of pure instrumentality blows away any sort of remnants of that solidification phase quite quickly, and enters just sort of like a metaphysical free fall right away. And so what Guénon criticizes or says happens once you enter the dissolution phase is that you have a breakdown of a couple of key sort of conceptual paradigms. The first one is unity into uniformity, which is that instead of having a society that organically creates a cohesion within itself, either through culture or ethnicity or class or sort of just practical, maybe not practical, organic, I guess is the word I used, organic sort of collocation. You instead move towards sort of quantitative differentiation into predefined boxes. And this isn't anything new. If you read any sort of Marxist critique of capitalism, that's essentially what it does. It reduces everyone to neat categories that you can sell products to. But it's important to understand that Guénon criticizes this on a civilizational, spiritual level. You lose sort of any sense of what a civilization is, in a sense, what Spengler calls the moving force or the energy that sort of births it. The definition of what that is, the core of that, gets eroded very quickly through this. Next up, it's the worship of statistics. It's to treat people as aggregates, as interchangeable units. A focus on the average man, which is something that in reality doesn't actually exist, but that many societies decide to govern on regardless. So this becomes the main basis for all planning that the society does. And any sort of individual difference becomes noise to be sort of averaged out. And this correlates with some of the more interesting critiques against democracy, for example, where you have writers like Knut Ledeen, who writes that true liberty is monarchism, essentially, by saying that the tyranny of democracy removes any sort of individualism. Then you have the hatred of secrecy, which is, I think, almost a... Gwinon always talks on a higher power, but this makes me think of... on a higher level, sorry. This makes me think of Gilles Deleuze, who has the concepts of deterritorialization and reterritorialization, is that Gwinon says that any sort of rite, any sort of ritual that might serve to keep information contained to the people who can make use of it is lost. And for us in modernity, that seems kind of strange because we're used to it, especially now with the internet, you know, all information all over the place is available to us. But in reality, just because you have information available to you, it doesn't mean that that information or that knowledge is of any use to you, or it might even be harmful without the proper, again, initiation. And Gwinon really likes rituals, initiations, guilds, etc. So to go back to my point on Deleuze, it feels like specifically in America, a lot of the sort of hatred of secrecy in that sense is driven by a merchant class, to use a Napoleon term, where the merchant dislikes secrecy because he would like to sell information, essentially. So it inverts the entire point of it. So if you're listening to this and thinking, hang on, but there's a lot of things that are secret in modern society, it's not about, you know, the knowledge being secret. It's about controlling the access to it and profiting off of it, as opposed to controlling the access to it because it's not actually for everyone. And that's a very important qualitative distinction. And the last one is simply that the result of all this is that you strip sort of any sort of true individualism from the individual in a society. So you flip it, and Gwinon says that individualism is actually a process of quantity, not quality. So if you strip away anything that is qualitative about a man, so his caste, his tradition, maybe his vocation or his craft, then nothing is left except the interchangeable units, maybe your you know, your height or your weight or your your hair color, or even ethnicity in a certain sense, and then you're no longer unique, you're no longer a qualitative difference from the person next to you. And so that's a bit of a, I guess, speed crash course in the whole critique that Gwinon presents, where sort of the American diagnosis comes into this. I would say, and this is where, you know, my input starts to come into this, is that America as it is today, due to its nature, has become sort of the apex of quantitative modernity, in Gwinon's words. It's not the origin, because Europe was the origin, but it's become sort of the maximalist expression of this. It's because it lacks any sort of medieval institutional residue that Europe still holds. It sort of becomes a laboratory for all of these effects to run amok. And it's not just that it's happened, it's that it's becoming worse over time. Sort of it's becoming more quantitative as time goes on. It's almost like it's speeding up. So going back a little bit to how this happened, in my view, you started with the qualitative residue that was there. I mentioned sort of the quasi-aristocratic figures of Ford, for example, where capitalism sort of almost took on a bit of a paternalistic bent for a while. where the industrialist was the person who had the vision, who had the responsibility, who decided particularity, who decided the exceptions, and you start over time just by the nature of these people dying out, as is sort of a weakness of monarchy in a sense. You interchange these people with professional managers who by themselves are creatures of quantity. They are made to be interchangeable. So this becomes, so that their sort of founder paternalism becomes replaced with human resources, which is a very maternalistic and not a paternalistic concept. Their visions become replaced by shareholder value, which is also a purely quantitative number. And the relationship between the owner, the vision, the king, and the worker is so impersonal that, you know, it's just system and labor unit or something like that. And you see this in every discussion that comes out of America and sort of, and also makes it a way over to Europe. I'm not saying that Europe is immune to this, but right now focus, of course, is on America. But it's all about the GDP. It's all about standards of living, you know, square footage, caloric intake, how many cars you own. It's all about keeping the dollar reserve as the world reserve currency, because we have to keep the number going up. The sort of modern new wave of private equity, where sort of the nation is asset stripping itself in a weird sort of like self-cannibalizing way. And if you want to sort of make a very rote, I guess, critique as well, it's obviously the gig economy. No employer, no employee, no, just everyone is just an independent contractor to everyone else. And you just get rated by an algorithm, right? Sorry.
I would also say that there are kind of more kind of crass elements, like notions of just bigness, I guess you'd call it.
Yes.
Have to be the biggest, have to be number one. That seems to be like an obsession with, you know, all of these sorts of things, which are almost kind of childish in a way, but they, I mean, we've certainly seen a lot of it in the past month.
It's a bit of a silly example, but you know, Twitter X has become more and more silly as time has gone on anyway. So let's just use it as an example. Recently with the whole Greenland thing and the comment sections of anything that was happening was, you know, every time Europe would do something like, oh, we're sending, you know, some troops to Greenland as part of this, you'd go into the comments and there would be this MAGA people talking about how many fighter jets America has. And it's just, sure, I mean, if America wanted, they could, you know, level Greenland with bombs. But that's not really what we're discussing here. And just talking about how big your number is isn't necessarily part of this discussion. But that's where the American mind goes. So
it's also just, I mean, Morgoth made a video recently where he made this point. It was a pretty good point, I thought. It's just not true. America can't, if it wants to, is it doing a lot of work there?
It is.
Like an internal, there's like an internal and external reality and a set of constraints that means that it's just not going to do it. Doesn't have the internal political capital to do it. We're talking about a nation that kind of gets fed up of or loses the will to fight a war in a place like Afghanistan.
Exactly.
Or anywhere else, any pick a war. And now we're talking about, you know, flattening Greenland or invading Canada. I mean, this is just fantasy nonsense again.
Yeah, it would be horrible, and especially if they were Greenland, maybe. But they had a hard time fighting in the desert, and they're going to have a hard time fighting in the snow. So against essentially an insurgency force. So, but yes, as you said, it's if it wants to, is doing a lot of heavy lifting, it's not very realistic to think about that. But I mean, all they think about is that we have 40,000 fighter jets and you only have 1,700 or something, right?
I will say though that I've seen, a lot of this sort of thinking from NATO bros against Russia as well over the past. I mean, there's been a lot of people who say things like, "Oh, the combined GDP of the NATO countries is this, the GDP of Russia is that, therefore we will win." I
Yeah,
mean,
that's always
the argument is literally as crass as that. And people in this country make that argument all the time, as if something like a war is just a mathematical formula decided by the reign of quantity, if you want to put it that way.
Yeah, exactly. And it never was, right? I mean, history is full of examples of the opposite, frankly. So, moving on a bit from the sort of economic reductions that sort of the reign of quantity imposes on America, you also get the democratic individualism that sort of applies quantity to the politics as well. In the same way that the industrialists imposed this sort of feudal quasi-aristocratic order, the founders themselves did also have a lot of these thoughts. They weren't necessarily all, they were in a sense the 130 IQ Anglo meme saying that democracy is for the discerning man. And yes, we as the founders, we as the aristocracy should have a say in how we govern the nation, but a lot of them were against letting everyone do it. Now ultimately that's what happened, but there were certainly pushbacks both ways there. There's also the idea of sort of the progressive expansion of that franchise as well. In the early period, senators would be appointed by the state legislature, but ultimately they would become individually elected people. So it's not just happening on the electorate. It also happens to the system itself. It reduces itself. It sort of dilutes its power, its possibility for action, to do anything other than sort of record these quantitative ideas. So the terminal stage of the democratic part of America within quantity is, of course, one person, one vote. That's the legitimate principle that underlies everything. But there's no other basis for political standing without being too getting too into Plato's Republic. But there's no, there's no expectation of any wisdom or knowledge or virtue within the voter. So it's sort of illegitimate by its own definition. By giving everyone the franchise, you also admit that, we can't all vote fairly on a point or on an issue. But of course, it's a pure numerical equality, right? We're just saying that, okay, one vote is one person. That looks very good. It feels very good within quantity, and so that becomes the basis. And once you do that, and once you have that as a given, that's also when sort of the reign of statistics enter the equation, because statistics and getting polls and getting all of these numbers to do politics becomes almost, it's either more important or the way to do politics itself. It's just, do you have the source, do you have the statistics to browbeat someone else, instead of thinking about actually, what do we want to do with this country? What is the vision? Who are we? Where are we going? What is our identity, et cetera, et cetera. And sorry, go ahead.
No, I mean, there's a lot of there's a lot of things that spring to mind as you've been talking. One of the aspects of it that I've always found interesting is how individualism and individuality under the reign of quantity, even though it's espoused as this ultimate value, as per John Lennon's Imagine, blah blah blah, the ultimate manifestation of it ends up being like crushingly conformist. And there's a video that always springs to mind when we talk about this, and there's I don't know if you ever saw the video for AC/DC's Thunderstruck. Have you seen that video? If you can imagine, the AC/DC, the band, are on the stage. They're doing their number, Thunderstruck, right? So, jumping around, playing guitar, whatever. But then every single person in the crowd is wearing an AC/DC t-shirt. And I'm aware that they're a British band, not an American band, but it's the same. We're talking about the same principle here. Every single person in that crowd is wearing the same AC/DC t-shirt and kind of like dancing and moshing to AC/DC. And I've always thought that there's this weird thing where it's like the doctrine is individualism, but the actual manifestation is everybody's exactly the same in conformity in their moshing to AC/DC. You know, it's the I'm an individual because I listen to Pink Floyd idea, but everybody is listening to Pink Floyd. So that's one thing that sprung to mind. The other thing that sprung to mind about, like, we're seeing like really odd aspects of democracy play out in America where, obviously, as the author of Populist Illusion, I say democracy is always an illusion everywhere and always. Your vote doesn't really do much. There's a permanent ruling class, et cetera, et cetera. But in a way, there is something else that democracy does psychologically. We're watching it play out at the moment in America, and we have done in previous times under Joe Biden and so on, where voting for the president becomes a vicarious power fantasy for like your party or whatever. And as the discourse has become more nasty, I mean, there was this video going around of Tim Pool screeching, basically, this is about the ICE stuff. And he said, "I'm not licking the boot. I am the boot." Right? And this was him kind of like...
Because he voted for it.
I mean, yeah, this is him saying, "I am the boot. When the government officer does this, it is me." Right? So there is this kind of like... I mean,
insane.
To me, this is like a kind of pure expression of... democracy in the way that maybe some of the ancients would think about it, as a kind of just a kind of mob thing where they see themselves in the power, even though obviously Tim Pool is not in power.
It's an interesting Pool,
but anyway, go on.
It is an interesting observation, because that is sort of one of the consequences of this, is that ultimately democracy itself stops being instrumental, right? As you said, it becomes its own sacred quote-unquote religion. I mean, of course, we have issues with stuff in Europe as well, but there's a lot more room, I feel, because you don't have that identity connected to the politics. There's a lot more room to sort of critique and demystify democracy, to break with the elected MPs and stuff like that.
One question I had, though, and I'm going to just try to like play devil's advocate for a second. A lot of people watching this would be saying, "Well, hold on a second," especially if they're American, they'd be like, looking at it, America's a much more religious place than Europe. Europe has lost God. Europe has become atheist. Europe has become like spiritually bankrupt. Communist, they'd say. Whereas, of course, America has a lot of religious people in it. Outwardly speaking, it looks pretty religious from the outside in. Yeah. How is this not a counter to what took going on? That'd be my question.
Well, I mean, first of all, you could criticize Quinnon himself for being a little bit shaky on religion. He did, I think he converted at some point to, was it Sufism or something at the end of his life? That's the ultimate answer.
It's worth remembering, though, that Quinnon, like Evelow and all of these capital T traditionalists, would make a distinction between the exoteric religion and the esoteric religion.
That's true, yeah.
Whereby the exoteric religion is for the, is kind of like has become, a temporal order that has already been emptied of its true spiritual significance. That's what they'd say. Yeah. And before he became a Sufi, Quinnon went to literally every single secret society in Europe, I think, every lodge, every and he was disappointed by what he found. So that's why he ended up going to Egypt and being like, well, I found the one authentic one. It's still alive. Okay, it's not French. He was French, obviously, but still, this is authentic. This is true. This is authentic. So that's why he became a Sufi Muslim. It's not like he went and become a Wahhabi or joined the Shia mosque or something like this. This is a very particular, it's like an esoteric strand, kind of heterodox form of Islam, if you want to put it that way. So,
true.
Anyway, go on. Yeah.
Anyway, so essentially, yes, Europe is also to some extent quantitative. I mean, again, this is why Quinnon is a bit of a hard thinker to wield, because he would say that everyone is has fallen. So, what I'm trying to do is to say, okay, where are we at in the fallen stage? What is the current moment? And I would argue, and this is very difficult, this is going to be very difficult, I think, for your American audience, and I can already see the comments about, immigration and all that stuff. Europe has a better orientation, as what Quinnon calls it, that the orientation matters, not just your level of quantity and quality, the total orientation of that composition. And a lot of the qualitative residue is still available in Europe. The structures and the vocabulary is still there. It was European rationalism who for a while sort of synthesized this and was able to sort of stem the tide. But I'm not trying to sort of say that Europe is by default better than America in this sense. I'm just saying that if I'm going to bet on one of them to survive that, I think I'm betting on Europe.
I mean, I've always tended to agree with that, although my approach is, some might argue, quite quantitative. I just look at the demographics. I mean, as a shorthand,
that is
I look
part of
at,
it. Yeah,
I just
that
look
is
at,
sort of what Richard Spencer does as well. He sort of shortcuts through ethnicity to arrive at the answer, in a sense.
Yeah, although that is, I mean, I guess Quinnon would not agree with that, because he'd be like, well,
no.
He'd, you want to look at the spiritual content, and he'd want to look at the qualitative aspect. There's been a lot of talk recently about trade and about European sovereignty, and, Keir Starmer's gone off to China, right, today. This has been a big talking point. And one of the interesting things, though, is how Europe has tried to position itself in terms of like the market. Now, this is going to sound like a strange leap, but it still tries to use quality and distinction and marks of excellence as a way to sell itself, even within the reign of quantity, if that makes any sense. Whereas, other country, I mean, China almost goes the route of what Carlyle would call the cheap and nasty, unlimited reign of quantity, dump your old batteries here and stuff like that. So there is even within the material considerations, some aspect of this still manifests itself. Like, it matters that, the British famous used to over-engineer things. Germans still do, I think. Mm-hmm. But like the idea that a product is going to be, even if you pay a bit more for it, it's, you understand what I'm saying? It's like, it's still, there's an extra consideration beyond simply the quantity.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I would say during my lifetime, that even that has eroded a great deal.
It has, yeah. I can see that. I would argue, again, that because of our history, even though it's in the industry and maybe in the products produced, we are also sort of becoming victims to it. We still retain the, let's call it social technologies or maybe philosophical tools, as I mentioned earlier, to sort of critique our own democracy in a way that the Americans don't. The Chinese forgo it entirely, right? But the Americans don't have even the sort of surface level skepticism to have the, what's the word I'm looking for? I guess conceptual space for discourse on doing things that aren't democratic. And I'm trying not to slide too much over into one of the other conversations I hope we're going to have. So having those tools in our tool belt, I think, is going to be a lot more useful sort of in this century than the tools America has.
Well, very, very interesting. In the interest of time, sorry to be all rain of quantity, but we have to wrap things up. Where can people find you, Walrus?
You can find me on YouTube. You can just Google for or search for A Walrus, or you can watch our show, The Longhouse, that runs every Thursday night, where we generally try to talk about Scandinavian European politics happenings. It's hard not to talk about the Americans because the Americans keep inserting themselves into our matters. But if that interests you, if a sensibly centered, different take than you'll get from most other right-wing commentators on X is interesting, you can check us out. I'm also on Twitter, same name, A Walrus, or at Walrus in a Suit. Mostly Twitter today is just shit posting for me. I had to put that stuff down a long time ago because it's just become worse over the years.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you would like to convert some of your reign of quantity into quality, you can pick up a course at the Academic Agency. So, you know, like how we did that? Kind of effortless.
Yeah. You know, I had to mute myself. That was very good.
Yeah, because you'll get what I'm selling is quality. It's making yourself qualitatively better in exchange for a very small sum of money. So pick up a course at the Academic Agency today. Buy it now. Trivium, the bestseller there. And I'll catch you all next time. If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the Academic Agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just 3 of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.